From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, the story of being the descendant of a slave owner and one of that man's slaves. The story of having both oppressor and oppressed in your bloodline. We talk with Andrea Stewart about her new memoir, Sugar in the Blood, which traces her family tree. Stewart's great-grandfather, four times removed, owned a sugar plantation in Barbados. He had children with at least three of his slaves, including the woman that became Stewart's forebear. Those children became slaves, too.
That is the quintessence of the hideousness of slavery, isn't it? That a family member could own their child or own a series of children and keep them in continued slavery and live comfortably with that. It made me understand slavery or see it in a very, very personal, intense way.
And Milo Miles reviews the new Yola Tango album, Fade. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I want to thank Dave Davies for filling in for me last week while I took the week off. My guest, Andrea Stewart, is the descendant of a slave owner and one of that man's slaves. She has a bloodline that she describes as blending the history of both oppressed and oppressor. She suspects this is true of many families which, like hers, are mixed race on both sides. Stewart has written a new book called Sugar in the Blood, which traces her family tree, beginning with her white ancestor who left Ireland for Barbados in the late 1630s. His great-great-grandson owned a sugar plantation in Barbados and fathered children with several of his slaves, including the woman who became Stewart's forebear. Stewart's book also describes the history of slavery in the Caribbean, where she was born and raised. Her father became dean of the medical school at the University College of the West Indies in Jamaica. As a child, she spent her summers with her extended family in Barbados, where her grandparents owned a plantation. Andrea Stewart, welcome to Fresh Air. When did you start thinking about the fact that one of your ancestors was owned by another one of your ancestors?
I don't think I actually thought about that till quite late in the process of writing my book. It was really one of those things that kind of hits you sort of later on. I mean, it very much began as a process of being interested in my family history. So it wasn't until quite late in the day that I had this moment of clarity, maybe 4 years into the research, that I realized that this was the truth of it. That was the reality of my life, of my family's story, that we, you know, one side of my family had owned another.
And what did that mean to you?
I think I found that a real kind of one of those aha moments, you know, where you sort of think, that is the quintessence of the hideousness of slavery, isn't it? That a family member could own their child and, or, you know what I mean, and own a series of children and live with that and keep them in continued slavery. And it made me understand slavery or see it in a very, very personal, intense way.
In trying to find documentation of your slave-owning ancestors and of your ancestors who were slaves, one of the things you found was that there was documentation of your white ancestors, but for the slaves, the only documentation you found was what?
Well, the irony of slavery is that, and it's true whether it's on mainland America or in the Caribbean or South America, is that the system is such that you only know what the white plant who owns you has recorded about you. So it's always through the conduit of this other person. So what I could know about my slave ancestors were the things that were recorded by their owner, and in the case of my ancestors and their father, in his inventories and mentions of slaves for sale or documents that he'd created, which are usually about transactions and or money in relation to them as stock.
So I'm going to open to the page now of the family tree.
Yes.
So here it is. There's Robert Cooper Ashby, who is your great-great-great-great-grandfather.
Yes.
And then there's women on either side of him in this family tree. There's Mary Ann Ashby, who
yes.
is a slave, who became kind of like his wife after Robert Cooper's wife died, although they couldn't marry because she had been a slave and that would have been illegal. At
yes,
the time.
That's right, yes.
But they had how many children together?
11.
It's a lot.
It is a lot, especially since many of the children were born concurrent with his legitimate white wife, who had only one child, and also with other relationships with slave women on the plantation. So right. He was a very busy man.
How many slave women were you able to document that he had either sexual relations with or children with?
Well, I think we kind of came down to about 4 or 5 groups. I suspect, of course, that there would have been more. It's just a question of what you can work out historically. And apparently this was completely common in the Caribbean for planters to have, you know, kind of quite a large number of of family groups. A contemporary of Robert Cooper's had six separate little family groups, and there are rumours of plantation owners on the other islands who, one French planter declared that up to a third of his slave stock came from his own loins, was the quote. So it was quite common, this very profligate sexual behaviour with slaves.
That's just kind of chilling, what you just said. It almost sounds like you're breeding your own slaves to work the plantation.
I think there is certainly a degree of feeling like that. It's sort of that you are kind of producing your own workforce. But also I think it's that sort of sense of claiming your total power over everybody in the plantation world over which you preside. His legitimate wife would have had very little redress. There was no chance really of her leaving him, as all the money that she had previously brought to the marriage was now in his name. So everyone, from his wife, legitimate white wife, to his various other liaisons, really had very little say in what happened to them in the world that he presided over and created.
One thing you speculate about, you speculate that your great-great-great-great-grandmother, who had been a slave, mm-hmm. was probably baptized before the slave owner had sexual relations with her, because you say that most of the slave owners had no compunctions about sleeping with a young teenager, but they were reluctant to have sexual relations with somebody who hadn't been baptized and was therefore a heathen.
Yes, I mean, with one of his groups of children, Suki Ann, he baptized her at 14, and that was often something that planters did if they were going to be in a slightly longer term relationship with an individual female slave. While they may have, you know, kind of one-off relations with a slave that they just picked randomly on the plantation, usually if the relationship was going to last, it was quite common for them to get the slave woman baptized, which is an ironic thing, because obviously they felt that was a rather virtuous gesture, which is extraordinary when in fact that they were, you know, basically raping underage girls. But that was thus are the ironies of slavery, I think.
So the first documented slave ancestor is John Stephen. He's the son of the plantation owner Robert Cooper.
Yes.
And the unknown slave.
Yes.
Who gave birth to John Stephen. What's the first documentation the earliest documentation you were able to find for John Stephen?
The first moment I discovered John Stephen was in an old inventory, and he was described as being 14 years old, coloured, which was the term that the West Indian planters used for, or certainly the Barbadian planters, for those who were mixed race, and a labourer. I was looking for him because the good thing about Barbados is it's a very small place, and a lot of the law of family law does get passed down. So I had a sense that I was going to find this person. We knew that he was Robert Cooper's, because even in my generation, there has always been talk of Robert Cooper, because he was such a large and affluent planter. His reputation and the stories of him have kind of lingered in the community. So that's how, but all of it, I have to say, is hearsay. I mean, we as a family assume that all of the, I think we're talking about 18 children of mixed descent, that he in some way prioritized. At no point does he ever admit, even when he was living with them, he doesn't describe them as his children in that way. So we know this because of what the family knows, if you see what I mean, what's been passed on and what we know for sure.
And the earlier documentation of John Stephen that you found is in what was called a slave return that was kept by Robert Cooper, the plantation owner. And that was required. A slave owner at that time in Barbados had to keep a registry of their slaves. What was the reason for that?
It was the end of the slave trade. One of the important decisions after the end of the slave trade in 1807 was, in order to prevent illicit slave trading in the region, planters had to submit a yearly list of the slaves on their plantation, just so that they couldn't sneak on slaves who had been illicitly sold in the region. So they started documenting their slaves very carefully. And then later on, of course, they would then become compensated when slavery was itself abolished, because they were compensated per head of slave. So it was to their advantage to make sure that all the slaves on their plantation were indeed recorded, so that they would get the maximum amount of money.
And just to clarify here, that, you know, in Barbados, the slave trade was ended before slavery was ended, so you couldn't, like, import slaves from Africa, but you could still own slaves.
Absolutely, that's right.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Andrea Stewart. We're talking about her new book that's part memoir and part history. It's called Sugar in the Blood, A Family's Story of Slavery and Empire. Let's talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Andrea Stewart, and she's the author of the new book, Sugar in the Blood, A Family's Story of Slavery and Empire. And it's the story of her family tree in Barbados, where her great-grandfather, eight times removed, first came to Barbados, and her great-grandfather, four times removed, was a slave owner who had relations with an unknown slave, and that's where her family tree really starts. And her book is also basically a history of slavery in Barbados, and that history is a little different from the history of slavery in the U.S. So let's get back to your family tree, which you've traced back to a slave owner, your great-grandfather four times removed, and an unknown woman slave who he had relations with. Their son, John Stephen, spent three decades in slavery before slavery was ended in Barbados. What did he do after he was freed?
We have traces of him as, doing kind of a number of, kind of finding a place in the community. He became a shoemaker. I assume he also went on being a carpenter, because that was the trade he was given on the plantation. He married a woman of a similar caste, also a mixed-race slave, a very prominent planter. They had, I think it's six or eight children. He kind of managed to have a certain genuine quality of life, really, in that the privileges that were set up by being the son of a planter carried on through his life. To some degree, that meant that he had he had advantages that ordinary slaves just didn't.
After some of your ancestors worked as slaves on a plantation, how did your grandparents come to own a sugar plantation in Barbados?
Well, it always seems to me an extraordinary irony that my grandfather would decide, or rather his father would decide, that it was a good idea to go back into sugar after the history, the torrid history that our family had had with that particular crop. But I think, you know, even at the turn of the century, and we're talking about the turn of the 20th century, it must have felt like sugar was still the biggest game in town. It was still the historical crop of the island. To be a planter was to be at the absolute top of the social tree. And so in some ways you can see that for successful businessmen, even those who came from a slave line, the idea of becoming a planter must have felt like real success. And I think that was why my great-grandfather decided to buy and also start to farm a plantation again.
So we're talking about grandparents who were what they would describe as mulatto. They were mixed race. They were the descendants of the slave who had children through the slave owner. So
yes.
Who were their workers when they owned a plantation?
Well, yes. I mean, as I said, I was thinking about this when I was writing the book, and when I was a little girl going up to see my family's plantation, the workers were people who were darker skinned than us and who were basically people who remained, who would have been the sort of bulwark of the kind of slave world the century before. They were the ones who didn't marry or were, you know, when I say marry, they didn't become involved racially with the planters and or quite so much. So they were tended to be the poorer and blacker Barbadians. So it was ironic that you had this juxtaposition of a family like mine who were given a certain degree of privilege, not least the colour of their slightly lighter skin because of their interrelationships with planters, and their world being farmed by and cared for by workers who hadn't had that same history.
How did your grandparents and great-grandparents treat the workers?
I think that my grandfather was eccentric, I would say, is the nice way of putting it. And I think that he very much cast himself in the role of planter. Of course, times had changed enough that the kind of horrible extremities of being a planter with along with violence and was no longer possible illegally or even, you know, in a social sense. But he was, I think, rather overbearing. He very much cast himself in the role of planter, drank too much, gambled too much, womanized too much, and was very much, it was a role that he couldn't quite shed.
So knowing that your family is a result of, illegitimate children that a slave owner had with an unknown slave, how does it make you feel knowing that your mixed race grandfather and great grandfather had illegitimate children too? It's not really a word I like to use, illegitimate children, but children out of marriage.
Well, I suppose, to be honest, it was completely so much a part of plantation culture and carried on being part of plantation culture all the way through up until the present day, really, that it feels, I wasn't at all surprised. I mean, when I discovered that my grandfather had four additional outside of marriage children, that's what they were called in Barbados, I was surprised that I didn't know, because it's a small island, but I was not very surprised. And I was, I remember my uncle telling me a story about how he found out about one of his illegitimate brothers and sisters, because one guy in his class said to him, "Oh, you see that guy over there? He's your brother." And my uncle turned around and met this man, and he was indeed his brother, by another woman who worked the plantation. It's amazing how powerful the kind of archetype of the plantation was, and I think this is true on mainland America and in the Caribbean, about how the behavior of the plantation carried on after slavery ended. It was an archetype, a way of living that just has enormous power and resonance, and just went on long after officially slavery was over.
Your father is a doctor, and he was the dean at the medical school at the University College of the West Indies in Jamaica. He was knighted for his contributions to medical education. So I presume that when you were growing up, you had a pretty high status in the islands. You know, your grandparents owned a plantation. Your father was dean of the medical school. So can you talk a little bit about your status in the islands and how race and the color of your skin did or didn't figure into that?
Yes, I mean, I had a very lucky upbringing as a child in that sense that my father was a doctor, and we had a very comfortable, pleasant life, really. I think I mentioned in the book that we were the first generation of black children who could enjoy the fruits of a tropical Caribbean childhood without slavery, kind of yawning over us, really. And yes, I think I was very, very lucky. I think the idea that idea of race and status in the Caribbean has changed, not entirely changed. I think that there's still a kind of recognition that people who have lighter skins, who are obviously descendant from both planter and slave, do tend to still have certain amounts of privileges, and it's not an accident that up until, say, my mother's generation, people were very actively making sure that they married other light-skinned people. And I think there's very, very many sort of parallels with America in this regard, so that people could maintain the privileges associated with those realities. But I think now I think that's much less significant in that way. I think now certainly Barbados and many of the islands are much more of a meritocracy, and there's a much stronger emergence of kind of, you know, my father being very typical of quote-unquote darker-skinned, but, you know, very dynamic men who've come forward and kind of dominate the middle classes. So I think it's a privilege that now is kind of not as important.
Andrea Stewart will be back in the second half of the show. Her new book is called Sugar in the Blood, A Family Story of Slavery and Empire. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Celebrating Fresh Air's 25 years, the Neubauer Family Foundation salutes WHYY and listeners like you, committed to new ideas and civilized conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Charles Schwab, providing retirement options for a tomorrow that is wide open. Learn more at schwab.com/retirement. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And from Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, how the slave society in Barbados became the model for the plantation system in America, and why slavery ended in Barbados before it did in the U.S. More with Andrea Stewart, author of Sugar in the Blood, A Family Story of Slavery and Empire. And Milo Miles reviews the new album by Yola Tango. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Andrea Stewart, author of the new book Sugar in the Blood, which traces her family tree. Her great-grandfather, four times removed, owned a sugar plantation in the Caribbean island Barbados and fathered children with at least three of his slaves, including the woman who became Stewart's forebear. Those children became his slaves, too. Stewart describes her bloodline as blending the history of both oppressed and oppressor. Her book also describes the history of slavery in Barbados. The history of slavery in Barbados is significantly different than the history of slavery in the United States. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that slavery. You describe Barbados as the first slave society in the British Americas, and the first society entirely organized around its slave system. And you say it became the model for the plantation system throughout the Americas. What made Barbados the model?
I think Barbados became the model because it was the place in the British colonies where they found their cash crop, which was sugar in their case, but on mainland America we could discuss tobacco or cotton later. They found their crop, and they worked out how to create a working system which involved the importation of slaves from Africa, how to organize gangs and groups, how to organize it in a kind of working as a workforce, how to create laws that would police it, how to create a kind of racial story that would justify it. They did all those things and created that model, which then became, and you can see its links in kind of mainland America and indeed across the Americas generally. I mean, we must remember that, for example, the Carolinas were settled by the very early Carolinas were, at least half of their early governors were from Barbados. So, and you had a vast kind of backwards and forwardsing between, I mean, now we think of America, mainland America, and the Caribbean and South America as somehow very distinct, different places. But certainly the Caribbean and mainland America in those days were described as the Americas by the British, particularly colonists. And many people who had great plantations on mainland America also owned plantations in the Caribbean, and vice versa. You had enormous trade links between the groups. They were, in historical sense, the same place, which I know that we find hard to imagine now, but it was. And so those interactions meant that what happened in the Caribbean had enormous influence on what happened in mainland America.
And you're saying that it was in the Caribbean, specifically in Barbados, that slavery was codified, that there were laws, there were practices that were written down and codified. There was a law in 1661 that was passed called For the Better Ordering and Governing of Negroes.
Yes.
And I think one of the things that this law did, correct me if I'm wrong, was that it clarified the differences between slaves and indentured servants. So there were also indentured servants in Barbados. What were the differences?
Yes, it's quite fascinating because, of course, we forget now that mainland America and in the Caribbean, the first servants were indentured white laborers who worked a term. They were given, in exchange for their passage over to the Americas, they were given, they worked for 5 years, or it could be 6 or 7, depending on the agreement they had with their owners. And then they were free, and they were given a certain amount in the hope that they could then start a new life in the new world. So it was, Barbados, like much of the Americas, was actually initially a European world. The dominant workforce being white, and the owners also being white, and so therefore you had. It was only after the kind of realization that sugar was going to be able potentially to make the money it was going to, that they realized that they simply didn't have the same stock available of white indentured servants that they would need, and hence shift over to slavery. So the white indentured servants worked in parallel in the early days with black slaves. And there was an enormous sense that it was important that these two groups didn't become close. There were a number of rebellions where the two groups worked together because they were actually, of course, suffering the same, much of the same terrible ill treatment and abuse and neglect. So the laws of 1661 made a real effort to give certain privileges to white indentured servants that were not given to the black workers, in order that the two groups would not feel that they had common cause, so that they would not get together. And mainly they made a lot of, there was a lot of racial significance put on the separation between these two groups. It's fascinating to see how racism is clearly invented at this point. There's a letter by one planter whites being sent home, saying, we describe ourselves here as the term whites, he said, is how we describe Europeans here. And they really created that term whites in order to separate themselves from blacks, who were therefore became the kind of the complete opposite, and so on. It was a very, very canny move to create, to make sure that these two groups didn't come together.
You write that in Barbados, as slavery grew, whites in Barbados were afraid they'd be outnumbered by slaves. Was that more of a fear on the island of Barbados than it was, say, in mainland America and the American South?
Yes, I think this is one of the acute differences between the two. And I think of the two countries, or the two sets of conditions, the Caribbean and indeed a lot of South America, there was this real, Barbados, for example, was the slaves were four times the size of the white population by the 18th century. So there was a real reality that slaves outnumbered the white population, which created a kind of siege mentality that was extraordinary. This never happened in mainland America. So the slave population never had the same level of threat for the white population, which is not to say that they were not horribly and brutally maltreated. Of course they were. But it was not the slave owners of the Caribbean, and some of them were of English descent, some French, some Dutch, Spanish, all lived in a state of extraordinary paranoia in relation to the number of slaves that they were surrounded by. Hence the particularly draconian and disgraceful treatment of the slaves in the Caribbean and those parts of the Americas.
Slavery in the United States ended with a civil war. But several decades before that, in 1833, the slaves in Barbados were freed. What brought about that emancipation?
Well, I think one of the things I feel very passionately about was that in Britain, where I live, the story or is very much around the importance of the abolitionist movement in Britain, and all the various people who were associated with it, and very much put this down to the abolitionist movement. But the reality was, I think that the slaves worked as hard for their freedom as the abolitionists did for them on their behalf. Because I think that what was happening more and more, particularly in the Caribbean, because that's where my story is set, was that more and more people, more and more slave revolts were happening. It was becoming so fractious and difficult that it was almost the point where the British authorities were feeling this is impossible for us to contain. The great spectre of Haiti was, of course, the great turning point. The 12-year struggle on that extraordinary island, in which the black slaves of the island managed to defeat both the British Army and the great French Republic, and create the first slave-free state in the Americas. Is one of the kind of biggest unforgotten stories of our age, and I think of that of the whole of the Americas. It's an extraordinary tale.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Andrea Stewart. We're talking about her new book, Sugar in the Blood: A Family's Story of Slavery and Empire, and it's about her family tree in Barbados, and also about the history of slavery in Barbados. She traces her family tree to a slave owner and one of his slaves. Let's take a short break here. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Andrea Stewart, and we're talking about her new book, Sugar in the Blood, A Family Story of Slavery and Empire, and it's part family history and part history. It's the story of her family tree. She is from Barbados, where Her ancestry traces back to a slave owner who impregnated one of his slaves, and those two people, the slave and the slave owner, are her ancestors. Her book is also a history of slavery in Barbados. So slavery ends in Barbados in 1833. Mm-hmm. You've said that you were part of the first generation that grew up more out of the shadow of slavery. What was different, do you think, for your generation? What's the point of demarcation there?
Well, I suppose I think that my father's generation, for example, the whole world of the plantation, its ethos, its ideas about what was valuable and who was valuable, really still overshadowed the life on the island. And I think, you know, very much African Americans will probably sympathize with that. I remember my mother was rather beautiful and entered a beauty contest when she was in the 50s. And of course, she wouldn't win because there'd never been a black beauty queen in all the beauty contests. And that didn't happen until, I think, the 70s. So that there was, and you know, my father, I remember, joined a club in Barbados where my grandfather worked. And it didn't allow black members until 1975. So the kind of ethos of the plantation, the racism, the attitudes to, kind of workers and people and so on, really cast a very long shadow, a shadow that was very, very evident for a very long time. And I think that this, as I say, this is something that, you know, the African-American experience kind of echoes. It, once slavery was over, it took a long time for it to really go away.
So when you moved to England, which was back when you were a teenager, and what year are we talking?
76, I think it was.
Okay, and you moved with your family because your father accepted a position there.
Yeah.
Did the color of your skin and your light skin black, did the color of your skin mean something in England that it didn't mean in Barbados or Jamaica, where you lived the previous part of your life?
The color of my skin did mean something different when I moved to Britain, whereas in the Caribbean, my slightly lighter skin marked me out as being perhaps potentially a little more privileged. In Britain, there was none of that subtlety or ideas of about race. It was very much I was a black person and that was that. And one was very much reduced to a series of stereotypes and rather dull stereotypes at that about what it was to be a black person.
Do you think that in England there's a different understanding of slavery and of the racial after effects of slavery, because the slavery wasn't in England? You know, the English colonies had slaves, but I mean, some of the English colonies had slaves, but that wasn't happening in England itself.
Yes, I think it's genuinely true that one of the reasons there is a difference between Britain and mainland America was that there is that sense in Britain that it was something that happened long time ago and far away, while in America the slave experience very, very much coexisted on the same piece of ground. And I think that reality has made it irretrievable in America's history to be something that was dealt with. What I think is fascinating in Britain is how little memory contemporary Britons have of the reality of the fact that when that my family's story first started, Britain was not very far away at all. I'm not talking geographically, but culturally, it was, you know, people like my first ancestor, who was an Englishman, were absolutely called themselves and described themselves as Englishmen transplanted. They were still English. They still had the same mores, attitudes, behaviours, and they believed themselves to be English. And I think so there's a real difference in how these two groups have dealt with slavery. And I also think that the fact that America had such a strong population of number of population of black people has made it incredibly important to come to terms with this extraordinary history, while in Britain we're a relatively small minority. I think it's been easier for Britain to ignore the history of their slave past than it has been for the mainland American.
Is the Plum Grove sugar plantation still owned by your family?
Yes, I mean, it's no longer a working plantation, and I think they're going to sell it and it's going to become real estate, which is now much more sort of lucrative than sugar plantation space is, if you see what I mean.
Will you be glad when that chapter of your family history is over, the plantation chapter?
It's an extraordinary feeling. I have an enormous, and this is the irony of it all, is that I can remember and spent so much of my youth and being at my grandmother's and grandfather's plantation and, you know, listening to the swaying sound of the cane and running around, this little magic world of beautiful gardens that surround the plantation house that then were bracketed all around by all this sugar cane and the knowing the workers. And, you know, generally it was all for me a very idyllic adventure. And so the idea of it being over is both painful because it represents to me very much my Caribbean, my childhood, my past, my family. And then another part of me thinks that maybe it's time for the island, just for me as well as the island, to close the door on the plantation story and to walk into the future.
I'm wondering finally if, because of this book about the history of sugar and sugar plantations and slavery in Barbados, where you're from, and also your book is a history of your family tree, if eating sugar has a different meaning for you than it does for me. If you think about all of that every time you put sugar in your coffee or, you know, eat something that has sugar sprinkled on it.
That's a fascinating question. Originally, when I started, oddly enough, doing the book, it didn't particularly click. And it was not until I was I was reading some of the work by the abolitionists, and one of their big kind of campaigns was that it was blood-stained sugar, that was what they described it, that it carried the blood of slaves. And I remember actually at that point putting some sugar into something and thinking, oh, it's this, you know, and realizing that this commodity, just as, you know, and I thought again about the way that commodities, in my case it was sugar, in America the parallels would be, as I say, cotton or tobacco, how these commodities have such real visceral impact on the way our lives unfold, and how extraordinary that is, that we don't consume them with any of those realizations, but that's the truth of it.
Well, Andrew Stewart, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been delightful. Thank you.
Andrea Stewart is the author of the new book, Sugar in the Blood, A Family Story of Slavery and Empire. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Milo Miles reviews the new Yola Tango album, Fade. This is Fresh Air. The indie band Yola Tango formed in 1984 and for the past 20 years has consisted of the same three musicians. Music critic Milo Miles has a review of their new album, Fade.
The band Yola Tengo would seem to be quite un-rock and roll in that it's a very stable and long-lasting operation. Since 1991, the lineup has been the married couple, keyboardist Georgia Hubley and guitarist Ira Kaplan, along with bassist James McNew. All three play additional instruments as needed. Yola Tengo has been with the same label, Matador, since 1993. But if they lack rock dramatics, I would argue that the group knows as much about the modes and manners of rock and roll as anyone who has ever played the music. Kaplan and his guitar are particularly enamored of rock's electric noise, the delights of distortion and feedback fantasia. On Fade, Yola Tengo get that aspect out of the way on the first track, Ohm, a song about refusing to feel discouraged. Over the years, Yola Tengo has been more and more drawn to pretty, catchy tunes with an intriguing dab of mystery inside, a confessional that makes you feel like you've heard a secret, though you can't quite say what it is. Hubley's plaintive vocals on Cornelia and Jane hint at a beloved intimate going through trauma or crisis. But the focus is on outsiders who don't understand, and on unanswered questions like, sending the message it doesn't get to you, how can we care for you?
I hear them whispering just out of view. Still unknown, what's inside of you? Outside your window, neighbors peering at you. How can we care?
Newcomers to Yola Tengo might want to start with a more insistent and straightforward release like 1997's I Can Hear the Heart Beating as One. But for those used to listening to the slightly encoded collective diary of the group, Fade is a feast. All previous Yola Tengo records on Matador were produced by Roger Moutinho, a very simpatico soul. This time the band reached out to John McIntyre, known not only for studio work, but drumming with the band Tortoise and a host of others. Fade has strings and horns unlike any previous Yola Tengo, but very much swaying in harmony. The final track, Before We Run, may ponder how to make the most of our fleeting days, but the lasting impression is the deft interplay between strings and brass. Yola Tengo, all grown up, but not a whit stuffy. Still, if I had to pick a favorite tune on Fade, most endearing, fresh but characteristic, it would be Is That Enough? Kaplan's extended sigh about the ambiguities of love in a long-term couple. Whether it's unsaid jokes or undeclared affections, he notes there's just no way that it's enough. Kaplan even casts a quick shadow of despair when he sings, What can't come back's what we can't bear to lose. But the music and words on Fade as a whole are pure affirmation of life and living. For Yola Tengo, if what they have is not enough, it's plenty.
Things we did on thinking, the joke we left unsaid, unsure how and when we were misled. To very few, and all that matters for me is you.
Is that enough?
it's not enough. No, if it's unclear the way I feel for you.
Myles Miles reviewed the new Yola Tango album, Fade. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Nell Beschenstein. John Myers directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
See so well. Is that enough? Oh, is that enough? Well, it's not enough. No, if it's unclear the way I feel for you, it's true. What can't come back's what we can't bear.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. From the Cy Sims Foundation, supporter of the Cy Sims School of Business at Yeshiva University at cysimsfoundation.org. And from the Gilchrist Foundation, in support of NPR's commitment to coverage of the arts. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Michael Apted, the director of 56 Up, the eighth in a series of documentaries that has followed the lives of several British men and women every 7 years, beginning when they were 7 years old. Also, we talk with Rebecca Luker about her new album of songs by Jerome Kern. She starred in Broadway revivals of Showboat and The Sound of Music. Join us.